It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
It's summertime.
Toronto has a really good pool culture, and we're going to the pool this afternoon.
Here's hoping. When I lived in the States briefly as a child, it was in the suburbs, and I remember being struck by the absolute lack of public pools, because I was privileged enough my whole childhood to be within walking distance-ish or like biking distance of two pretty nice public pools. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once I like hit tween age, one of the first things we were allowed to do without our parents' supervision was like bike over to the pool and chill there. And it's a kind of a luxury, apparently.
Apparently. Well, some less privileged people.
Well, you have to have like membership. You have to pay to go to the pool. Oh, yeah, totally. I was living, at least.
No, public pools are so awesome. And a big thing in high school for us was going pool hopping. And it started becoming another thing during the pandemic. But it's like a big thing in Toronto where you just break into the public pool at nighttime and swim around with your friends. Skinny dip on occasion. Ooh. And it's super fun.
Yeah, I think one of the sadder parts about becoming an adult is being like, I don't know, at 27 if I should be breaking into pools, but...
Well, yeah, and like in 2021 or 2020, like peak COVID, but just like during the summer months, I think we pool hopped one pool and we got in there, and then one of our friends was like, oh, hey, dude. And it was like his little brother's best friend who had been the lifeguard of the pool who had let a bunch of his friends in. And it was like them who were teenagers and then us. And we were like, oh, no, no, we're too late in life.
I remember even turning 18 and going pool hopping. I was like, oh, shit, like the repercussions are worse for me now if we got caught doing this.
Yeah, but why can't adults have jouissance? Why can't we go do something illicit and bad?
I know. Why is it sad when adults break the rules?
Yeah, why can't we, you know, something something?
Why can't we be young and wild and free?
Yeah, she was crazy, but she was free.
Absolutely.
I'm like that in spirit, I like to think. I think I said that about myself yesterday to you.
Yeah, today you were vocally expressing your discontent with the prices at the pharmacy we were at. And in a way, that's sort of living life freely.
Yeah, I was like yelling really loud about the prices. We're getting gouged, guys. And I hope Galen Weston, if you hear this, yeah, fucking, I hope you're having a really bad morning.
I hope you have a sunburn that like peels.
I hope you have an anal fissure or something. Like something so uncomfortable. Like, I hope you're deeply uncomfortable.
For the non-Canadians, these are the bajillionaire family that have a monopoly
on all of our everything. Pharmacies, yeah. And also our grocery stores, and then have been recently price gouging. So like I'll buy two things from Shoppers and it'll cost legitimately $50. Like it's, yeah. Actually, you don't think it'll ever be that bad, and then you put it out and you're like, whoa.
And you'll see something on sale and you'll be like, whoa, this is discounted. And then you'll look at the sale price and be like, that's too high to be the regular price. That's insane.
Yeah, it's truly, truly insane. On that happy note,
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about when art meets the internet. Is the sun rising on a new creative era, or did it set before it even began? If you like our show and want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have monthly bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us a lot.
So much.
Maya.
Hannah.
Have you ever heard the term death of the album get thrown around?
I love the concept that the term is death of the album get thrown around, because I was like, death of the album get thrown around, you know? Like, I like that that's all one phrase together. Instead, it's just death of the album. I have heard the phrase death of the album. As you know, I love to pronounce the death of various artworks and art forms. So, yes, I have heard.
Ironically, we've
actually invented that phrase.
Yes. Ironically, we've been discussing the supposed deaths of various mediums. But the exception here is that this is not Maia's provocative declarations.
What are you talking about?
The claim of the death of the album has been sort of thrown around for decades. Obviously, this isn't to say that the actual approach of an artist packaging their songs in like a 13-ish track long album has died out. People still very much do that. But like many have tried to argue over the years that the album as a piece of art, as its own thing, ought to be eulogized, and that the current streaming era just may be the nail in the coffin. But before I go into that, I want to give a brief history of the album. So I got a lot of this information from an article by Michael Tomansky for The Atlantic, so just going to say that up here. But basically, music used to be played off of discs called 78s, and these discs held about 3 minutes of recording on each side. And so music was generally made in accordance to that. This format worked all right for some genres, but for fans of classical music, where let's say a symphony can go over an hour in runtime, this obviously doesn't work. So if you wanted to listen to Mozart at home, for example, then you might find yourself buying a set of 10 discs for one single piece of music. And so the packaging for these multi-disc sets resembled photo albums, and that's where the name The Album came.
Ooh, kind of like the Facebook photo album.
Yes.
It's all the same.
It wasn't until after the Second World War that this would all change. So in 1948, Columbia Records would debut the LP, or the long playing record. And at first, LPs are only really utilized by genres like classical music or jazz or for movie soundtracks. So for the olds, generally like popular music and music for young people was still centered around singles, those 3 minute long songs. And full length albums acted more as compilations of those songs. You might find like one artist have multiple versions of an album depending on like where it was distributed, and you'd find like the same songs, or it'd be like a different compilation of songs under a different name, but there just like wasn't any consistency. They weren't like, this is something that I've honed as a completed works. But this would change in the mid-1960s.
What happened?
When I began working on this episode, I did threaten you that I was going to be talking at you about the Beatles.
And she loves to do that.
This is where I have to make good on that. Are you ready?
No. Go for it, girl.
I'm holding you captive.
Send it.
So the trajectory and artistic choices of the Beatles do work as a pretty good case study for the trajectory of popular music as a whole in the 60s. Because in the first half of the decade, like many artists, their albums were these like compilations of songs loosely strung together or soundtracks for their films. Something like Help or Meet the Beatles. They were teeny boppers, so, you know, the songs were shorter, they had a lot of covers. There wasn't really that much setting them apart from other acts at the time.
I wanna hold your hand. That's
well,
me.
Yes.
That's my impression of the Beatles.
Which, so good. But then, in 1965, they debuted a more mature and experimental sound with Rubber Soul and left the other girls quaking in their boots. They were influenced by acts like Bob Dylan and the Byrds, and also like their recent foray into recreational drug use. And it was basically their entrance into like the more serious adult music world.
Was this when they discovered India as well?
This is the first appearance of the sitar on Norwegian Wood. The songs weren't really for dancing or hearing live, like they're more for smoking a joint on the living room floor. And After this, they were essentially in an arms race with the Beach Boys, who tried to outdo them with Pet Sounds, only for the Beatles to put out Revolver a few months after that. Everyone's trying to top each other. Everyone's discovered, like, what music could be.
I love the concept of, like, the Beach Boys of all bands going conceptual, because it's, like, they were such teeny bopper artists. I know the Beatles were as well, but it felt like they had even slightly more of an edge than the Beach Boys, so I kind of love, well, I love where they went.
Totally, and I mean, look, perhaps I'm biased, but, like, I don't think that Pet Sounds is comparable to Rubber Soul, but I like that they were all pushing each other to try new things.
And you're biased.
So they topped Revolver then with a 1967's Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is sort of widely regarded as, like, a milestone in popular music. It's presented as a performance by a fictional band. The Beatles start the album playing them, like, as themselves with their more traditional rock sound for only the first song. And then they embody these new characters, and it allows them to really experiment, like, sonically, thematically, and with the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a goofy album, and I can see why it's perhaps not everybody's cup of tea. It goes all over the place. It's kind of nonsensical. It was literally made for and by people on acid. Mm-hmm. On acid.
On acid.
On acid. But it is often credited with, like, signaling in what we're going to call the rock album era, and helping create, like, a previously non-existent youth consumer base for LPs.
Mm. The 20th century's discovery of young people is, wow, fascinating. Scary and fascinating.
It's funny because then they'll, like, forget about them, and then they'll be like, oh yeah, you people want to spend money.
They discovered India. They discovered young people. The 20th century, huge milestones.
Can you see the difference between something like Sgt. Pepper's and, like, that packaging of an album versus something you might find earlier on in the decade?
Oh, totally. I think, like, the 60s were an incredibly fascinating decade to begin with. It's one of the few decades where the change in popular culture was so abrupt and so quick, and you can see it visually. Like, you go to 1963, women still had, like, beehive hairstyles. You go to 1965 or 6, and all of a sudden it's, like, people having these, like, middle part super, super long hairstyles, men having these big mustaches, and it's, like, just even in the visual changes of the decade is fascinating to begin with. And also then, like, the early 60s versus the late 60s in terms of, like, civil rights and, like, public consciousness is so different. Obviously, these things were, like, brewing for decades before that, but it's, like, just the general mass culture of it all is fascinating. So, yeah, I think looking at the Beatles, even from a visual standpoint in the early 60s versus the late 60s and, like, the way that their fashion changed. And then they kind of kept the fashion of the late 60s for, like, the majority of the rest of their careers, you know what I mean? Sans Paul McCartney, who's, like, so elderly now, but, like, you know, or, like, Ringo Starr, but, like, you know what I mean?
Well, the two ones that are alive.
The two ones that are alive, exactly. Whereas, like, early 60s, they're all in their cute little suits.
They're, like, and teddy boy look.
It's very clean cut. So even there, you can see the change, let alone, like, sonically. Hearing them incorporate sounds that are way less palatable to everybody, and, like, they incorporated a lot more, like, talking. Again, they had, like, the sitar and, like, just, like, abnormal sounds integrated into their music, whereas, like, the earlier music is something that could easily be played on the radio. Like, it's just such a different, well, yeah, totally. Such a difference.
Like, the earlier music, you're like, oh yeah, these, we were just talking about One Direction before we started recording, and it's like, that's where those comparisons
as we do.
That's where the, you know, but that's where those comparisons make sense, in that I think that it was sort of the hype around this group of boys. Not to say they weren't talented instrumentalists or whatever, but, like,
it was a cheerleader effect kind
for
of
sure
thing.
Yeah. And then whatever, like, something snapping and them deciding to, like, lean into experimentation, which they really did over, you know, from 1965 to 1967. Like, it was just such a drastic,
you know, we are acting like that rat boy phenomenon is a thing that's only happening now, but, like, the Beatles really did originate that rat boy thing. Like, girls love a man who looks like a mouse or a rat.
Oh my god, I remember my mom talking about how she thought Ringo was the cute one. They all liked Ringo, and I was like, girl, why?
I get that more than John and Paul.
No, it's all about George.
It's all about George. My dad's, like, biggest claim to fame is that he loves to say he looks like George Harrison when he was younger. I think he did.
I kind of see it.
Oh yeah, he was, like, gaunt as fuck and had really long hair. He also had a perm in the 70s, which was crazy.
I love.
I can see it. Skinny.
Yeah, skinny boy. Skinny rat boy. Rat dad, Summer.
Rat dad, oh my god, he would be so sad if he heard me say that.
I don't think your dad's a rat.
He doesn't look like a rat, but yeah, no. Anyways, just thought I'd throw that in there.
it's cool to see an album sort of be bookended in the way that they did. They use audience applauses to signaling the beginning of a performance. They end off the album with applause as well. It feels more akin to like sitting down to watch a movie, like you're sitting and absorbing it as a singular piece.
It's an immersive experience. You could say even it's a bit postmodern. Not to be as insufferable as humanly possible, but...
You should just start calling everything postmodern.
Yeah. Well, we already do that.
Well, we should lean into it.
But you're listening to the album as a full piece and you're immersed in it, but you're also thinking about the fact that what you're listening to is art. Like, you're thinking about the thing. Yeah. You're kind of almost removing yourself from it as well. It's interesting.
Totally. I mean, they're like, they're art albums.
It's meta,
and
yeah.
And that was sort of what this period became about. Like, yeah. Not just with them, but with, like, all of their contemporaries. I think everybody was being inspired by each other and pushing each other to, like, try these new sounds to really expand what they were doing could be. I mean, they stopped performing live and just started making music for the listening experience, which I just think is very interesting. So, you know, there were a ton of cornerstones of the rock album era, which keeps going into the 70s. You had, like, rock operas like The Who's Tommy, Dark Side of the Moon. That's, like, an album that you're supposed to really just, like, close your eyes and listen to. One of my personal favorites, which I don't know if it's considered a cornerstone, but The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and The Spiders from Mars is, like, a concept album that I remember, like, when I was shown it as a teen, I was like, wow, it blew my mind. And then even just outside of, like, a concept album, people were putting out much more holistic packages of work. I mean, we think about, like, iconic albums like Blue or Tapestry, like, even moving a bit outside of, like, traditional, like, rock and roll. There was just such a bigger priority on, like, an LP encompassing something more than just a list of songs.
Yeah, and of course, like, records had existed way before this had happened, but I think it's such a perfect object for something like this. Like, the actual art for the album is, like, on the thing. It's huge. It's, like, you're looking at it, and you can hold the object as a whole thing. So it also feels like it lends itself perfectly to this idea of the concept album.
Totally, and then people were getting really into, like, art of the album, putting in liner notes, like, yeah, making exactly like a fully packaged experience. But eventually, as happens, like, the trends change, and high concept guitar rock had other forces to compete with. Disco, punk, and then later MTV all sort of knocked down its dominance. I'm sure you can take a gander as to why.
Wait, say the first two.
Oh, disco, punk, and MTV.
I think those all created completely different listening experiences and, like,
exactly.
And the audience's relationship to the music. Like, for punk, so little of it was actually about the music itself, and so much of it was about the experience of going to a punk show. So that made it very, like, in person. I think MTV, you know, because of the prevalence of the music video, created a resurgence of the single because of the single song attached to the single music video is what was getting attention and, like, is what we were engaging with. And again, even with disco, it's like, kind of created to be danced to in a club, and it's meant to be paired with a bunch of other songs from different artists, like, strung together by a DJ. So,
well, yeah,
that would also be a different experience.
Exactly. I think there's such a bigger emphasis on DJing as an act and of finding works and, like, mixing works, and, you know, it's completely different. It's meant to be danced to. It's meant to be experienced bodily and not just, like, sonically.
As a huge fan of disco history, as a huge fan of disco, as a huge fan of house, as a huge fan of all of these things, I cannot help but look back at this era and say, oh God, why? Why did they do this? Worst thing that's happened in the past decade is that we made DJs think that they're artists. And I think we should go back to a time when they absolutely are not.
Well, but here what I will say is I think during the disco era, when this kind of style of DJing was so new, I do think that there is artistry in what they were doing. I think curating is...
Of course. I'm making a joke.
Yes, yes.
Like, I do think, of course, there's artistry to DJing. I just don't think DJs should have that much power in our society.
Oh, certainly not today. Not these little boys playing techno in Toronto.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, I like that era, but I also don't like what it gave way to, which is these little fuckers running around and playing, like, ambient soundscapes on the dance floor.
While we're trying to shake our ass.
Where there are a bunch of girls trying to shake their ass. Like, can you just play a song with lyrics and just, like, transition it? Thank you.
Oh, can you not play a singular beat for 5 minutes?
Well, yeah, like, make your SoundCloud tape and I'll listen to that while I study and do something boring. But, like, when you're DJing for a crowd, can you, like, think about the crowd? Sorry.
When I've picked out an outfit based off of how easily I can dance in it and then I can't even dance, if I'm only using the upper half of my body to like move to your music, then you shouldn't be DJing.
Yeah, and this is why I'm like, okay, yes, I guess you're an artist, but like also can you just pair that with the idea that like you're also here to make people dance? Like you are a little bit of a performing monkey, like just transition the songs. Thank you.
Put on That's That Mi Espresso.
Take my fucking request, and my request is that Mi Espresso, okay?
And then post the introduction of these newer genres and MTV, we then have like the technological advancement that comes with much more portable listening experiences. So the tape and the CD basically coming in and dethroning the LP and widening the boundaries of where you can listen to music and when.
And no offense, but the CD is way uglier than the record. I'll just say it now. Like, records just look better.
Yeah, they're classy as hell.
They're classy as hell.
They're sexy. So as we move into the later decade of the 20th century, I wanted to take this time to talk a little bit more about our personal musical backgrounds, because I would say as much as we love each other, music is one of the areas where we have less overlap.
We cannot talk about music together.
It's a contentious topic, but I think it's actually really helpful to have these like different perspectives and relationships to music in this overall discussion about listening formats, because otherwise it would just become like an echo chamber. And I do think that my feelings are ones worth being challenged. Mm. So I'm going to start with myself.
Mm-hmm. Please take the floor, talking stick.
Yes.
It's actually a therapy session for me and Hannah's friendship.
You can't see her, but there's a lovely couples counselor just up on the corner with her notebook. So when I was a teenager, my dad's friend gave me his old record player, and my dad sort of took this as his opportunity to like educate me on the music that he loved, much of which is from the classic album era. And I remember him pointing out to me like how songs on certain albums, like the Beatles, like how they would blend into each other with one song starting while another is finishing. And it just kind of made me see how you're supposed to be listening to these specific works, like not just in a complete album form, but in the order they were asked to be listened to, how you're supposed to pay attention to those details rather than like playing something on shuffle on my iPod, which I had previously been doing. Mm-hmm. And I think it just opened my eyes a bit more to like the ways you can experience music. Like, it just hadn't occurred to me before.
It's meant a bit more for like sitting and listening, whereas I think the shuffle feature really kind of encourages like a quicker listening experience, or like you can just kind of flip through and it doesn't matter because there's nothing that you're going to be missing out on if you flip through.
Yeah, totally. And you know, when someone chooses to put a certain song before another song, it's because they want you to feel this thing and perhaps then go into feeling this way. And so big pet peeve of mine is like on an album when it feels like the kind of track listing is random and you go from something really slow to something really high, or it just doesn't feel like there's like a graceful transition between songs.
Okay, not to be like so fucking annoying and bringing this up all the time, because not everything relates to YouTube, so that is really annoying. But I do find like on YouTube, even with like the little chapters, like there now you can have these automatic chapters that YouTube will create, and you have to check the box if you don't want automatic chapters. But people will yell at me being like, can you make chapters for your video so I can skip to the part I want to hear? And it's like, yeah, but the video is made in a logical sequencing so that if you skip, you're not going to understand the context of what I'm saying, or I'm going to be saying a counter argument and you're going to think that's the crux of the video. It's meant to be listened to as a whole. That's why I make it. So it's like, yeah, of course, with an album like these, it's like, yeah, just skipping. I hate that I just made a YouTube analogy.
No, but it's totally, so it's
but yeah,
totally accurate.
It's
yeah.
Like, yeah, you're missing out on like the narrative.
Yeah, the narrative and the context. Just also like, I don't know. I think artistic intent is important a lot of the time. And I think this is one of those places where I think it should be valued. But I also know, like, yeah, we grew up with very different music. You grew up with a lot more, like, dance music. I think our parents might have, like, opposite tastes in music.
Like, fully the opposite. Which they would hate each other.
Yeah, fascinating. And I would say, like, and I want to know if you agree, the album and, like, that packaging is less integral to the presentation of that kind of music.
Yeah, totally. I think, like, the music that I grew up with, like, my parents listened to a lot of mixes when I was growing up,
just
which
so
I don't know.
Crazy.
I don't know where they even got them. I can't remember. But they'd also have, like, I don't know, they'd listen to, like, fucking, my parents are weird. Like, my dad basically has this whole mantra where, like, he grew up in the 50s and he hates, like, this old type of, like, rock music and stuff like that because it reminds him of his youth. And he's very, like, future forward. I think he just doesn't love his youth, so I think it just reminds him of an era that he wasn't very happy with. But then also he feels like an old fuddy-duddy when he listens to old music, so he's very like, oh, I need to hear the newest music all the time.
Like, he listens to your SoundCloud mixes that you
find. He like loves the same DJ that I do, this girl Bianca Lexus. Like, he's obsessed with her, and it's like, it's really funny. But he, even now I get frustrated, because even trying to show him a movie from the 90s, he's like, no, I don't want to see that. And it's like a movie that he would have loved, but he wants to focus on like the now. So back then, like, it would be a lot of like 90s, early 2000s kind of like soundscapes. I don't know how to describe it. It would be like 90s electronic music, but with this like weird East Asian, like Southeast Asian edge. My mom is also technically South Asian, so it's like, it kind of made sense, but they were also kind of like yuppies. So like, we'd have these CDs from Enigma or something, but it's like, the actual CD doesn't really matter, you know. And an Enigma song will so easily be placed within another mix that isn't a part of a CD. I remember he had one called Buddha Bar that we'd always listen to, and I would get really depressed every time they played it. Like, it made me sad.
Why?
I don't know, it just made me really melancholy. But I was like, stop playing Buddha Bar, and they were like, no.
I had a weird phase as a kid where music made me melancholy in the evening. I don't know why.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, their music made me sad. But like, now it's really influenced the type of music I listen to, and also how I listen to music, which I'm not proud of. I don't like that I like mostly listen to individual songs, you know what I mean?
But what I wanted to, the reason I wanted to bring this up is that I think specifically with dance music, like, I don't think that there is anything wrong with that. Like, I think there is some music that is inherently like meant to be listened on a song by song basis, and that, you know, kind of almost like what we were talking about with like repurposing art in the Richard Prince episode. Like, some things are supposed to be moved around. They're supposed to be like placed in different contexts. They're supposed to be repurposed.
Yeah.
I think that there is like room for nuance between both forms of listening, and I want to get further into that like down the line.
Yeah.
But I think it's nice to kind of contrast our two
backgrounds. There was a song for this, but I can't remember what. But yeah, I find like I need to listen to a song that kind of like maximizes pleasure for me. If I listen to a whole album, there's going to be a bunch of songs in it I don't love as much.
Yeah.
So I don't want to listen to those. Like, I'll just listen to the ones I like. There are albums, and I think I came into that type of listening more as a teenager when I started discovering for myself these kinds of things. So like, I would listen to full albums, but it's still not how I like generally approach music listening. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to talk about this a bit more later, but I completely agree with what you're saying. And I think it's important to like kind of acknowledge how like the trends and the technology and the culture of each era also shape the role of music and like what we get out of it.
Mm.
I think there's a symbiosis taking place. In a 1998 article for the New York Times, John Prellis wrote, "Music has been inextricable from technology from the moment someone tapped together two particularly resonant sticks. And in the last century, the technology of recorded music has affected everything from the length of songs to the lineup of ensembles to the environments that music is made for. Where would psychedelia be without headphones, or hip-hop without booming car stereos?" What are your thoughts on that?
I think a lot of what is important to remember is that technology doesn't mean electronics. Like, a technology is kind of like, it's a technology. It's something that kind of has a purpose to like enhance human experience and human behavior. So like, two sticks tapping together is a technology. Every aspect of making music is a technology, unless it's just someone singing from their chest, you know what I mean? But like, the instruments we use are a technology. And yeah, whatever technology we're using will completely change the context of the experience of listening to music.
Well, yeah, and the form it takes on, right? Like, songs are 3 minutes long because we made discs that could only hold 3 minutes of music. And that's why that's the average runtime of a song.
Yeah.
It's impossible to take the shape of music out of like the context of the technology with which it was made.
It's like the home, it's like its confines.
Yeah.
So it both like enhances music, but it also limits it in other ways.
There's no like inherent way that it should be, is just to say that. In that same article, he also writes about the emergence of MP3s. Like, digital music files.
What you're listening to right now is actually an MP3 file.
By the mid to late 90s, CD sales were low. MTV and video games were, of course, being blamed. But little did they know that an even more threatening force lurked behind the corner, and that was the MP3. From its infancy, people were using MP3 technology to illegally pirate music online, and it kind of led the industry into a bit of a crossroads. They could see that digital was likely going to be the future of music listening, but they also understood that this threatened their bottom lines. And so Beyond even just issues over copyright, what this new technology allowed was the ability to have access to specific songs without having to buy a whole album. So like you were saying, if people just wanted to enjoy one song, they didn't have to go buy the CD and then like either record that onto a mixtape or just skip through all the songs. Like they could just get that one song onto their computer.
Yes, I did have Just Love Lockdown from Kanye West on my iPod Shuffle.
And you didn't even have to shuffle because you had one song.
I just had one. I think I had that and Heartless. And they both skipped a lot because I got them from LimeWire.
And those were the only two songs on
Yes, that was all I wanted to hear from Kanye at the time. I was like, that's all.
No. Wait, only songs from Kanye or only songs, period?
Oh, no, from Kanye.
Oh.
No, I mean, had many songs. I had like a whole Jethro Tull album. Why? I don't know.
I too only had those songs from Kanye. Maybe I had Gold Digger.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And it was like, I ain't saying shit.
I had I had downloaded a copy of I Kissed a Girl on LimeWire, and it was actually just President Bill Clinton giving his I did not have sexual relations with that woman speech.
Oh, and that is quite thematic, except kind of homophobic, because like that song's about being gay.
It's actually famously not.
Well, famously actually not. That's so true.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
And so in the post-album era, you know, popular music had shifted back to its pre-60s focus on the single, but consumers often still had to purchase these entire CDs, like we said, to own the singles. And so an album might have a couple good songs, but the rest was often considered filler. And once music started being offered legally online, there became even less of an incentive for popular artists to make these decent, complete albums. Because if you think about, you know, the 2000s and the early 2010s with the popularity of dance pop, it's pretty evident something like Katy Perry and her album Teenage Dream, which is really like widely regarded as like a seminal pop album, especially of that era. It's stacked with hit songs. And I would say there's a pretty good ratio of hit to filler compared to other albums. But it doesn't ask to be listened to as a complete work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she has a visual concept. She's got a vibe. But it's an era. It's not like an album.
Yeah, you rarely talk about like my favorite Katy Perry album.
Yeah.
And if you did, I'd be like, girl.
Well, people love Teenage Dream, but like, those are supposed to be played on the radio as singles.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think about this? Like, do you recall this sort of being the vibe of our childhoods with pop music, at least?
Oh, totally. Like, again, these artists were just known for what you had heard of them on the radio, which is often a single. I don't think I've ever listened to a Katy Perry album. Like, was Firework on Teenage Dream? Where was Firework? Didn't know that. I associate her with her, like, individual songs, not with her albums at all.
Yeah, I think unless you were like a straight up fan, like I would listen to like a complete Rihanna album because I had someone, again, had the CD and lent it to me, and we were still in more LimeWire days, less reliable. It was still nice to have a CD.
Oh, yeah.
But there were always skips.
Yeah, and also like they're like seminal albums from my childhood, like No Doubt's Tragic Kingdom or like the Aqua album. I think it's called Aqua. Like certain albums that like my sister would have given me as a kid, or like full CDs that I listened to on my CD player in my room while I played with my toys. And then it's like, yeah, once I started downloading stuff from friggin' LimeWire, that all kind of went away.
And also, you know, those were, yes, there was less of an emphasis on the album in the 90s, but I would say even like comparable to the 2000s, like.
No, it's still like a full piece of listening material. I'm not going to put a whole CD in a player and then just skip to my one song and then take it out. Like, I'll just put it on to listen to the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's annoying to have to, like, physically, again, with the technology, physically take a CD out, put another one in. That's what DJs are for.
Well, of course. Yeah. I had Tragic Kingdom. I bought it on vinyl in high school and it was see-through orange. It was very cool.
Nice.
Maya, has this episode so far struck you also as an exceptionally white music history lesson?
A little bit.
That's sort of in part because a lot of the nostalgia around the album is stirred up by white boomer men. And while much of my taste is aligned with white boomer men, my eyebrows are, of course, raised when I hear them argue that the high concept album died out over 40 years ago, which is why I've been sort of trying to talk about it as the rock album era and not the album era.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, rap, for example, is said to have begun its own album era in 1986 with Run DMC's Raising Hell. And jazz was utilizing the LP far before rock music was and inspired a lot of the artists of that rock era. In a 2017 article for Pitchfork, Mark Hogan wrote that Radiohead's 2000 album, OK Computer, killed off the art pop album as we knew it. But he says that the tradition of the art album was actually carried on in large part by Black musicians in genres which are equally as popular but less respected by the aforementioned white boomer men. Quote, across the last 20 years, monumental rap, R&B, and pop records like D'Angelo's Voodoo, Kanye West's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, and Beyoncé's Lemonade have filled the void of full-length statements with both artistic seriousness and mass appeal that was formerly largely occupied by guitar bands.
Well, yes, I will once again say that I think the best album of the last decade was D'Angelo's Black Messiah. Amazing. He kills the album.
Well, yeah, and I think, you look at Kanye, like, since College Dropout has been doing concept, like, high-concept albums. Like, those are pieces that are thread together.
Yeah.
And I think My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is just, like,
so good.
It's boring to even be like, this is one of the most significant albums of our time, but it's like, you can't.
That's going to be the new white boomer men, is like white millennial guys talking about My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy to their kids.
Oh, absolutely. I actually remember in high school thinking about that, like what albums were going to carry over in that way. And certainly, speaking of Beyoncé, it was a conversation we had about her that sort of led me to this episode idea. Because she has been experimenting with concept albums since 2009 with I Am Sasha Fierce. And her visual albums, Beyoncé and Lemonade, they did push consumers to at least do one complete listen through so that they could like take in the stories and the visuals of the album. Like, she created immersive experiences. She also has been utilizing like the surprise drop, which kind of foregoes the typical lead single model and presents the album as a unified front, which is also pretty great. Like, you have to listen through to find the songs that really stick out to you. And she's used internet culture to like make the album feel relevant to pop music again. Like, you're talking about Lemonade, you're not talking about single parts of it. But this is where I ask you, like, does it matter? Should it matter? Like, does the album still need to be relevant?
I think there's a bit too much universality placed on like listening to a full album is like good versus listening to a single is bad. Even when we're talking about like reading and stigma around reading and the shame we feel, like, I think I have a lot of like shame about not, you know, like a lot of the time I have trouble relating to our friends who are like, did you listen to all of Brat? And I didn't listen to all of Brat. I listened to like two of the songs from Brat. I didn't really want to sit and listen to all of Brat because I'm not interested in that. Or like the only album in like recent years that I've sat down and like listened to in full was Norman fucking Rockwell. I'm not like really that invested in the iconography of certain artists anymore. I just kind of like the songs I like. But I think there's a lot of like shame built up in that because I feel like I'm not participating in this kind of culture around artists. But at the same time, like, I do think it is a nice thing to be able to sit and consume music the way an artist would want us to consume it. Like, I don't think we have to do that, but I think it's nice to be able, like, I think just when we're thinking about the act of consuming art and like engaging with art, I think the act of sitting down and listening to a full album is nice because it speaks to other things, right? Like, what am I doing while I'm sitting down and listening to a full album? Painting, you know, like there's only certain things you can do while you do that. Or I'm hanging out with friends, you know what I mean? Like, it signifies other things that I think maybe are going to be falling by the wayside. Signifies something so different than like listening to a bunch of singles on my playlist, on my AirPods while I walk around the city. Obviously, you can do that with a full album, but like your attention isn't there with it. I don't know how to explain that.
No, I think it's true. And I think that's one of the things that sort of changed even before, you know, MP3s, is with Walkman, basically. Like, where you're listening to music and like the incorporation of music as like a background thing while you do other things, I think also changes how we value certain types of music or what we look for in music.
Yeah, the type of songs I'm going to be putting on my playlist, which like the majority of the time when I'm listening to music these days, it's when I'm walking around. I don't really want to hear like a slow, sad song while I'm walking around because it's going to fuck up my rhythm. Like, I need a song that I can like walk quickly to, you know what I mean? So only those types of songs will make it to my playlist.
Well, and then going back to Brat, like, I'm not sitting in my room listening to Brat with candles lit and the shades drawn. Like, I'm listening to something like that to kind of like fuel myself walking around at night, like stomping around in my shoes. Like, that's the kind of vibe. while perhaps Charlie XCX would disagree with me, I don't necessarily think that that's an album that has to be consumed in that form.
Oh, so many would unfortunately disagree with you, but I agree with you.
I think there's a lot of really good songs on the album, and yeah. I like the consistency of it, but
I love its marketing campaign.
It's great marketing campaign. It's meant to be played at the club. It does not need to be played with a through line.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And I don't think you should feel ashamed of those listening habits, especially because I did a poll on my Instagram and a good chunk of my followers participated. I asked people if they listen typically to albums or playlists, and majority of them said playlists. Like, I don't think that's something that you need to feel, and a lot of people expressed shame about it, but I think as much as I know I have my biases towards the album, and I think I used to be a lot more snobbish about it, I do think that technology changing things doesn't always have to be read as like a net bad thing.
You wouldn't believe it from listening to our podcast, but like, it's so true.
I'm trying to have a more kind of like, you know, holistic look at it. And I also think that nostalgia clouds a lot of our like feelings about this kind of stuff.
Totally. Although I do always respect and encourage a degree of snobbery, so I appreciate that you're snobbish about this.
Thank you.
I love this therapy session. We're gonna sing Kumbaya after this.
The only thing I will say is that as much as I think music can be listened to like in all sorts of forms, I'm a little worried about our present reality in the world of streaming. In the same New York Times article I mentioned earlier by John Perellas from 1998, he basically predicted music streaming. He goes, "The new model could be like a jukebox with listeners paying for each song or group of songs they download. Better yet, it could resemble cable television with subscribers paying a monthly fee for all the music they want to download and revenues distributed on the basis of popularity."
That's crazy.
Which is, he like looked into the future.
What is he, Teresa Caputo?
Slay.
I don't fully know what she does, but...
She's a Long Island medium. Mm. She talks to the dead.
Oh, well, okay.
So he has a fairly optimistic view of this future. He says, if monthly subscribers could download a song or an album on a whim, not just to hear it once, but to replay it often enough to understand it, general listeners' tastes could broaden and budding musicians could learn new vocabularies. The process wouldn't necessarily build new top 10 hits, which would still need mass broadcast exposure, but it could make all sorts of niche music purveyors happy. And it would be likely to prove that people's tastes aren't as constricted as radio formats pretend they are. Do you think that this sort of positive outlook he's expressing has like materialized in our current like streaming age?
Yeah, I think so much of what's amazing about these music streaming services is that like you can discover new music constantly. Like, I'm constantly discovering every single week new music. I love my Discover Weekly playlist. I use that to kind of like add to a seasonal playlist that I make each season. And yeah, it exposes you to artists that like formerly would have had to go through other channels. Like, as in the case of like every single person who gets famous online, like it is, I'm not going to say organic in this context, but I guess it's not organic in any context, but it's like the algorithm is helping lesser known people kind of work their way in there. And that's awesome to see. Sometimes someone that we like kind of know who will have like a small following in the realm of musicians will like appear on my Discover Weekly and I'll be like, oh, fuck, that's awesome.
There is like exciting potential for this, but I am going to put a bit of a negative spin on it. No. I'm sorry. Users on platforms like Spotify have like historically tuned into curated playlists like Rap Caviar, for example, which is a really popular one. It's basically how Cardi B blew up, to, you know, to find new artists. And up-and-coming acts have relied on them in the past to get their big breaks. And in that sense, like the people who were curating these playlists are functioning similar to radio DJs.
Mm. All I want to say is I discovered Cardi B because I was watching her funny-ass Instagram videos like way back before she had blown up as a rapper, and that's all I'll say.
Okay, and she's a pioneer of Cardi B.
To me, she's a comedian.
But in tandem with these editorial playlists, Spotify has also offered personalized lists under its Made For You section for years now. You expressed listening to like the Discovery Weekly. Like, have you listened to the Made For You playlist much?
No, because it'll be like music that I don't need to hear again. Because again, I'm always on to the next thing.
She's all about that bass.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. I have like in the past, like if I'm want a certain vibe and I'm like, okay, I want to stick within this and I'm feeling lazy, like I might go to a Made For You playlist. But in the past, I still felt like I was being shown new music through those playlists. And this music was usually, you know, fitting with the songs it was being recommended off of. Like, I felt like the algorithm was doing its thing. But, like, I've personally noticed changes recently, and I don't think I'm the only one. In the r/Spotify subreddit, I found a post that articulated what I'd also noticed.
Did you? Spotify having a subreddit is so funny.
There's a subreddit for everything, babe. The user asks, has anyone else noticed that Spotify has made a significant shift in playlist/music discovery over the past year? I feel like they have gone way overboard with the Made For You playlists. Back in the day, they used to have a ton of playlists made by their editors. Now it seems like almost every playlist is made for you, essentially AI generated based on songs you've already liked. While the concept is great in theory, I've been finding that all of these playlists are too repetitive and don't totally fit the genres they claim to. Sure, they align with what I've listened to before, but these playlists do not introduce me to any new music. Mm. And I've been seeing that a lot. Like, there are certain playlists you'll click on and it'll go made for your username. And, like, let's say I'm looking at a 70s road trip playlist. They'll kind of, like, fit random shit on there that really tangentially relates because they know I've listened to it. And I'm like, I'm not here to listen to my backlog of music. I'm here to listen to a specific kind of vibe.
I think that's the issue with all algorithms, to be honest. And, like, it's the same thing that people talk about even with, like, YouTube pipelines, right? Like, YouTube used to be, like, you'd look, oh, my God. YouTube is my Taylor Swift jar. But on the side feature, there'd be like a side kind of scrolling feature where it would show you, like, it would recommend you videos. But now those videos aren't recommendations that are like new videos that have popped up on YouTube. They're just videos that are in direct relation to something you had just watched. And it's like, well, I don't want to see that. I want to see something that's new. I want to be exposed to something new, not just the same shit that I see all the time.
Well, totally. And like,
and that's how you can go down certain pipelines too, because you keep getting recommended and recommended based on what you clicked on.
Well, yeah,
it's like you having a conservative feed.
Well, exactly,
because Hannah is conservative.
My Instagram Reels thinks that I'm a conservative Christian who like homeschools her kids.
Yeah,
and I am.
And me, I'm the kid.
And I will not get her vaccinated.
I'm a walking festation of
disease.
I don't even think festation's a word.
She's like patient zero for a whole lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
So it's interesting just to see like how it's no longer like you go to your Made For You section, but it's like a playlist that says it's by Spotify will sneakily be made for you. These were playlists that have previously been curated by people hired by Spotify for their knowledge of music and their tastes and kind of helping, like we said, like DJ a vibe, they are being replaced by algorithms. It may not surprise you, but Spotify, perhaps inspired by the like hyper-individualized approach of TikTok, has been replacing a lot of the human curatorial team with these algorithms. They recently laid off a lot of the team and they've been basically like putting us in an endless loop of like hearing the same five songs no matter like what your starting point is. And like I said earlier, musicians used to be able to find big breaks through being featured on like a Spotify playlist, but now they've incorporated this thing called discovery mode, which basically means you can, for a smaller fee out of your royalties, you can opt in to have a song be like flagged for the algorithm, so it's more likely to like be played on people's sort of algorithm driven radio. Because if you finish an album on Spotify, you'll start
hearing
songs.
It's like an upgrade
songs.
Feature for artists.
And I think that that's how that Mi Espresso broke through.
Oh, conspiracy.
Well, I love the song, but I truly could listen to anything and it'll show up on the radio.
Whoa, that's wild.
And everyone's been expressing that. There are literally articles about people being like, why did I just listen to 90s hip hop? And that's that Mi Espresso came on right after.
Well, yeah, Sabrina Carpenter has been making music for so long. And for some reason, this is like her big break. I mean, she's also putting her whole pussy into this.
It's a catchy ass song.
Going everywhere. But no, just like even marketing wise, like she's everywhere. But yeah, no, maybe that is a part of it.
I used to have a similar thing with Motion Sickness by Phoebe Bridgers. It didn't matter what I was listening to. I was once at a party and I guess it started sort of going on like the random algorithm curated shit. And it just kept coming on like every three songs and it was not the vibe.
That's so funny because the songs that Spotify always kind of like falls back on to recommend me or like plays right after a song I play are like Donny Hathaway's cover of that John Lennon song, Jealous Guy. That one always comes up. And then Be Thankful for What You've Got. Every single time that song will come up, or like a cover of that song or a variation of that song on every playlist ever, which is fascinating, but it's so different from Espresso, I guess.
But there is like a selection of a songs favorite, yeah. that like if I mean, it, yeah. if it's from the same era or there's like any slight similarity,
yeah.
it'll immediately put it on. When you look at like your genre playlist under Spotify, like the things it constitutes as jazz, I'm like, you are really stretching, babe, but you're trying to appeal to what I've already listened to.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, but if I'm trying to listen to jazz, I want to hear jazz. I don't want to hear something that I know that isn't jazz, or else I would play
it. And we can't fully criticize this because Spotify is the reason that our podcast has been recommended to a lot of people. Like,
of course.
We have been pushed up in those algorithms before.
And this isn't me kind of necessarily dunking on algorithm for music curation generally. I just think that right now there is such a push to like make things
hyper customized,
but in a way that ends up being kind of the same across the board. Like, yes, it's customized, but I also think that there's like a select pool of things that keep getting regurgitated and like it's not actually as specific as we think it is. But it just reminds me a lot of the TikTok algorithm like that. I mean, that's what kind of freaks me out, is that I think it takes the work out of like trying to find something new. It creates a bit of like a monopoly effect.
I mean, manufactured consent. Do I like the song, or is it just constantly being sold to me as a song I should like?
Well, yes. You know? All this is to say, though, that like, I know I've talked about being an album purist. I would say in recent years, I've definitely been leaning more into playlists. I've definitely like let Spotify carry me on its like little journeys. I don't want to seem like I'm criticizing that act of listening, because I think it's like the one that makes the most sense in our current age. Of course, that's what people are tending to do more. There haven't been a ton of recent albums where I've been like, I really want to listen to this as a complete package.
Not even Brad.
I'm sorry to say. Still the summer of Brad.
I thought it was Rat Boy Summer.
It's Brat Boy Summer.
I think I've seen that. Which is just Challengers.
Fuck. I just wanted to kind of get across the point that it's okay for arts to change with the technology, but I also do think it's worth raising a bit of caution about like how much the technology is pushing the art and how little the art is pushing back against the technology, which kind of brings me to my question. Like, do you think this does signal like the real death of the album? And if so, like, do we call it a murder at the hands of digital streaming, or was it just evolutionarily phased out?
Oh, such a good question. I think it's hard to separate something that's happening evolutionary-wise from something that's being deliberate. Because, like, I mean, all the fears about technological determinism are just making it seem like technology can't help but keep evolving. And it's like, no, there are always human hands at play and, like, human interests at play that push it forward and forward and forward, make it happen quicker. And so I think it's hard. Like, I am always scared to say something was inevitable with technology, which I probably have done so many times on this podcast. But, like, it's hard to say that it was necessarily inevitable. I think what's inevitable is that human beings are always going to try and make more money and capitalize on something. And so I think if the money is in, you know, evolving, if the money was in, oh, like creating LimeWire, if the money was in making these like hyper-specific algorithms, if the money was in making artists pay a fee to push their stuff up on the algorithm, like, I guess it always comes back to the human propensity for money. And I think that is kind of something that's deliberate, but it's also hard not to see it as also just like this very, very long-term trend. So it's kind of a mixture of both, I guess.
Well, I think when streaming came around, it didn't necessarily have to cement itself as the way we listen to music. I think we chose to start listening to music that way, and we kind of chose to use it. We chose to, like, yes, these transitions are being kind of presented at us. They are more convenient choices with all the other changes going on with technology, with having iPhones, and, you know, with just the way that, like, our lives are changing. But I do think that we've opted into this style as well. Like, I think there is a bit of a give and take. I asked a couple of our friends, like, we have a little group chat, and I was asking them, you know, if they thought the album was dead, and they all seem to be thinking no, that, you know, there are still a lot of really great albums being made out there, but they're not necessarily like popular albums. They're not necessarily being like widespread moments.
But I think like with anything, saying, oh, the album is dead isn't saying, oh, albums aren't being made anymore. That's not what that phrase is referring to. It's referring to like albums being a touchstone of popular culture. And I think
you're right
in saying that it isn't anymore. So like for any argument, there's always some like outlier evidence. Like, of course, albums are still being made, but the issue is that they're not at the forefront our listening experience.
I think that there was quite a dying out, at least within popular pop music, of the albums in the 2000s. And I do think there was a bit of a resurgence in the 2010s. I mean, like, think about Frank Ocean. Like, his albums were albums. They were consumed as albums. They were moments.
Well, and like with any, like a lot of the biggest artists right now, like Lana Del Rey, Ariana Grande, like everyone's talking about Eternal Sunshine. Like, they are being consumed as albums. They're just like the biggest artists we can think of. I think they are evidence that maybe it is still alive and well. But do I think that necessarily that's an across-the-board listening experience that it used to be? Like, no, probably not.
No.
Or there are so many things working against it, and, like, only the biggest artists can actually have their work listened to in that capacity.
No, I agree. I think it's the two things working together. I think there is just a natural process of change that comes when our technology grows, like the art made around it or for it is going to change. But I think it's been sped up by streaming. I think I'm just regurgitating everything we've already said.
I can't believe I said the word festation.
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.